Okay, Marcus Braybrook is, as I started to say before, when I have introduced him, as I have done many times in the past, I have often said that there is no one alive who knows more about the history and the dynamics of the global religious or interfaith movement than Marcus. He is the president of the World Congress of Faith, one of the oldest of the interfaith organizations, co-founder in London of the Three Faiths Forum. He's a patron of the International Interfaith Center in Oxford, and he's the author of just countless books, including Faith and Interfaith in a Global Age, 1,000 World Prayers, What We Can Learn from Islam, What We Can Learn from Hinduism. Those are all different books. And recently, Beacons of Light, a delightful book, 100 Holy People Who Have Shaped the History of Humanity. He's also the author, by the way, of Pilgrimage of Hope, and Pilgrimage of Hope is really the definitive history of the global interfaith movement. Many books we could talk about. But Marcus, thank you so much for being with us from Oxford.
What we've been talking about, the idea of as an impediment to interreligious dialogue, I asked Marcus just now, since there are so many reasons why leaders of religious communities, members of religious communities, and the communities themselves, so many things they have in common, so many things that would seem to support the idea of interreligious engagement and dialogue and cooperation and so on, what are the impediments? And I asked if in part it was a lingering sense of exclusivism. And exclusivism is the idea that only one religion can have value, only one religion can be true, and that since I know, of course, that mine is true, yours must be false. And Marcus was in the process of saying, yes, there is quite a bit of that that's still left. I would add that wherever you've got violence in the name of religion, you have exclusivism behind the scenes, or perhaps not even behind the scenes. It's an exclusivist mindset that makes it possible for me to want to do violence to you simply on the basis of your being in the wrong religion.
Can you hear me again now, Jim? Yes.
That seems better. How about everyone else?
Well, I can hear you much better, too.
Yeah, we can hear you much better. Okay, good. Thank you.
Our interfaith movement's progressing.
Marcus, I just said a word about what exclusivism is, because that's what you were addressing when we broke up. And let me ask you this. Next week, we're going to be talking with Paul Nitter. He's a peace counselor. He's a professor of theology at Union Theological School, and he's one of the most powerful voices for religious pluralism. I just talked about exclusivism, the idea that the truth of one religion demands that the others be false. Pluralism is the notion that more than one religion or many religions can have a purchase on the truth, can be valid, can be true, just as we say different forms of artistic expression are equally valid. You've also been a very significant voice, one of the major voices for pluralism. Let me ask you this. Can you comment on that? How would you explain pluralism? Do you think it's actually growing? And if so, isn't that another sign of cultural evolution in our time? That's a theme we've been exploring in these calls.
Yeah, well, I think for me, the sort of basic starting point is that the one God speaks through all religions. So I've never seen the sort of claim to be, I am a committed follower of Christ, but I believe that God, the same God, speaks through all religions. And if the God is a God of love, then that seems to follow. So I think there's a really grounding in theology, and you can find the same in Islam, that God could have chosen to make everyone belong to one religion, but he didn't, so we should be compete in good works. Guru Nanak's message, which were, some people call him Brahma, some people call him Allah, but again, it's the same reality. So I think you find that. I think, for me, it is grounded really in what I'd call the mystical experience, that the experience of many religious sort of teachers and holy people that occasion when suddenly they sense a oneness with all life, a oneness with the source of being, that there is a sort of underlying unity. And I think for those who have that experience, it's always one which cannot be fully expressed in words. So any religious language is an attempt to communicate something that transcends. I mean, if you think of all the poets who've written about love, and yet human love, you never can fully encapsulate in words. So that mystical experience also makes relative the various doctrines. I mean, I would say in the Buddhist phrase, they're like fingers pointing to the moon. That's why I think the sort of spiritual dimension of interfaith remains important, because if we only do it on the great basis that, you know, religions ought to work for peace, we haven't got the sort of spiritual impetus. What you say about whether it's growing or not, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the sort of postmodernist type of theology makes it more difficult, because they really reject any idea of universals. So there's a sort of theological argument about it. And one's very aware of much more practically. There are some countries who want it, some who don't. And whether, you know, whether we really have found a system to give equal value to different religions.
Mm-hmm. So which do you, I have often been heard to say in the last several years that I think the specter of spreading fundamentalism is actually much less likely as a future scenario than the broadening of pluralism. I hope you would give some credence to that.
Yes, well, I think in the end, fundamentalism is a negative reaction. It's the threat and the danger. I think people who don't want change, and they seem to be having ideas which undermining. And it's linked also to the sort of threat that Western culture has posed to many more traditional cultures, so that the religion seems to be undermining what is concerned. I mean, this is because I think religion is also, in many parts of the world, a matter of identity. Probably Christians and quite a lot in the West, we tend to think it primarily is a matter of belief. But I know sociologists have said, especially of Asia, that it's much more a question, you know, of what you eat and what you don't eat, what you, the food, what clothes you wear. And so another religion threatens your own identity. So I think fundamentalism is ultimately based on insecurity. So I continue to hope that the more pluralist attitude will spread. And I think more and more people, as they begin to meet people of other faiths or read their scriptures, recognize the spiritual wisdom there. And that, I think, is the transforming experience, which, of course, in one sense is difficult. It has to be a sort of individual. Each person has to discover that other traditions are not a threat, but actually an enrichment.
Recently, you've got an interesting story developing in Great Britain. Your Prime Minister, David Cameron, has just made the stunning statement that multiculturalism has failed in Britain. Can you give us your thoughts on that? Of course, many people who are aware of the multicultural experiments in interfaith dialogue, in education, and so on in Great Britain have long held it up as a model. And now to hear the Prime Minister say, well, it's not worked. I think he was arguing that it hasn't curbed extremism. My question would be, who knows how much extremism has never arisen as a result of the long tradition of multiculturalism. But what are your thoughts, your reaction to your PM saying multiculturalism has failed in Britain?
Well, I don't know really what he means, and I'm not sure what he does anymore when he's talking about the big society. But anyhow, I mustn't indulge in a political broadcast. I think there have been two threads. The basic, I think, approach, and the approach which most of us adopt, is that people should be free to practice their own religion and encouraged to do so, and that should be respected. Now, in England, Britain, that meant a shift from the Christian monopoly, because very much as an established
the Christian
church.
What? I'm sorry. Say again. A shift sorry. From the Christian. That meant a shift from
I think,
the Christian.
I think many of us in the churches, with sort of as immigrants came into the country, saw the proper role for the church to make welcome them and encourage them to practice and belong to their faith. And I mean, if I can give an example, going right back to the 1960s, when we were in the Medway towns, we came across a sort of small Sikh community had settled in the area, and the only place they could were meeting was in the back room of a pub. So the fellow clergyman and myself, we offered them the use of our church hall. And that was very fascinating. But a strong reaction from some Christians that we were betraying Christianity, and some agreeing that we were right, and got some correspondence going about it in the Times. So by and large, though, that pattern of welcoming has happened. The problem has been as whether that the groups have become too separate. Now, my understanding of the whole interfaith work, we've always been talking about shared values. We can respect people's difference, be enriched by it, but there are values that we share. I'm not sure that the sort of terrorist element in Britain is all that much to do with religion, though it uses religion to excuse its actions. Many of the young Muslims, and they're not the only extremists, we have extremists in all communities, but many of them are alienated not only from British society, as dominant society, but also from their own faith community. Because not all, but in some of the mosques, which are ones which are said to breed extremism, the imams have come, from Pakistan. They are not at home in British culture. They may not speak very much English. They certainly don't understand about the sort of mixed sex attitudes of how people, boys and girls, meet together in Britain. So they can't communicate with young people, young Muslims who've grown up in Britain. Partly, many of them, only some of them, are not achieving very well at school. And so they are alienated from society, they're unemployed, and so on. So there is obviously this virulent ideology, but I think the people who adopt it do so partly for other reasons. And what I really want to say is, I mean, not only Muslims, but others, the great majority are playing a very full life in British community and sharing in it. And quite often I've heard a Muslim speaker say, Britain's the best country to live in. Now, not advertising. But most of the English people would be much more critical. So I think he's reacting to criticism that the government hasn't done enough to root out extremism, and particularly saying that some Muslim leaders should do more. But I think it's really, I mean, either it's unthought out or it's political point scoring.
I think
it's actually thoroughly pretty unhelpful.
I think we would agree that this statement is a little premature, that multiculturalism has failed in Britain, and I think Britain is still a shining example of what you can accomplish with multiculturalism.
Well,
it's sort of like trying to prove a negative.
We've tried to do both. I mean, allow people to practice their own faith, but also to try and share. And I mean, as I mentioned about the royal family, they've gone out of their way to invite people of all faiths to come to events, services. I mean, any sort of state occasion now involves representatives of all the faiths. So I think a lot has been done to encourage that inclusivism and that shared values. So I don't quite see what he's getting at. I mean,
it seems to me that rather than fundamentalism is the wave of the future, and I think we have to wind down.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Marcus, that there was so much problem with the sound, and I'm sorry to all who couldn't hear either of us or as we were going on, but this has been tremendous, and we're very grateful to you for your...
Well, I was always talking about the virtues of silence, so those who couldn't hear either of us probably benefited more.
Marcus, you have the driest sense of humor, but of course, we appreciate it much.
Sorry?
Actually, we could hear you much better when you called in again, and I think
yes.
that the problems more or less corrected. I have a question for our participants. At this point, we have two choices. We can break out into small breakout sessions where panelists can discuss ideas with one another, or they can ask questions of you and or Jim by voting on their telephone keypad. So I'm going to ask participants for those two choices. If you would prefer to move into breakout groups right now, I'd have you press 1 on your telephone keypad. But if you would prefer to stay in the whole group and ask questions of Marcus and Jim, I would ask you to press 2 on your telephone keypad right now. 1 for breakout groups and 2 for Q&A. Oh, we have an overwhelming majority for Q&A, so I guess they want to talk with you more. Okay. Now, we'll facilitate that from our end. If you have a question for Marcus and or Jim, would you go ahead and press 1 on the keypad, and then I'll see your hand go up, and I'll try to get to as many of you as we can.
Harold? Shannon?
Okay, we have a question from Dominique Hope. Dominique, go ahead.
Actually, it wasn't me. I'm sorry.
Okay, put that down. Shannon Pugh?
Yes.
Would you like to ask your question, and who is it directed toward?
It can be directed to either Marcus or Jim.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My question is where do you come from when you're faced with the extremist ideas of like the Christian monopoly that we aren't willing to accept any idea that's new because we exist in this insecurity? And I'm in an area where there's a lot of the insecurity, and there is one way to find religion, and that's through Christianity, and it's kind of disheartening that, you know, I can't break through to people that I know, and I'm just wondering what would your advice be for that?
Marcus, would you like to reply to that?
I've had a very experienced person who's been working in this field say that you can't, in the end, argue people into a more open position. They've really got, but what he would do is tell people of stories so that they would actually understand that there can be real friendship and human relationship. Try to deal with it in the personal, not get into too theological. But I hope I've got your question right, because didn't hear it, all of it.
Yeah, I probably didn't come across very clearly on that, but that answered my question, just relating in stories to people instead of basically preaching to them, because that kind of puts people on defensive. So that makes a lot of sense, and I appreciate that.
I think a good Shannon, is it?
Yes.
A good background assumption is that someone who, as Marcus has said in his earlier remarks, someone who brings that kind of exclusivist, let's not say extremist, but just exclusivist, I'm right, therefore you're wrong, attitude, is likely to be someone that has very little experience of the other. And that's why I think the story aspect, as you share an experience you had with a Muslim or with a Jew or with a Buddhist or whatever it happens to be, chances are that you're planting a seed at the very least, or maybe breaking through, because it's a good working assumption that that person really doesn't know any Muslims or really doesn't have much, hasn't had much interaction with Jews or people of other traditions. So I love that answer of the going with a story rather than argument.
I would have added, the more you can have shared meals, the better. That's one of the great joys of interfaith work. It's the mixed meals you get. Eating together is a great way of breaking down barriers.
That's
okay.
Thank you, Shannon, and both of you. Let's take another question from Reverend Joseph Nemec.
Yeah, that's Nemec in Spokane, Washington. And I've been involved in an interfaith group now for almost 4 years. We are still at a point where it has not been possible. I'm the only pulpit minister that can find the time to participate in the interfaith, and the larger faith communities, there's a good size synagogue in the area, and there's a good size Catholic community. And because our interfaith council is so small, that it feels almost like they don't see us as a real part of the community. But we, because of that, we have not been able to grow, and we have taken a stance of education, that we're here to educate and bring, not trying to convert people, but just have panel discussions and stuff where people can understand what the different religions, how they see different portions of our life and stuff. Do you have any ideas on how to speak to the larger clergy to bring them to the table so that the local interfaith community will grow and have a voice in the community rather than being looked at as a bunch of New Age or New Thought people that do not have a large population here anyway?
Can I take a shot at that? I have something to say, and then Marcus, you can reflect on it. One of the things that we learned at the Parliament of the World's Religions is that it's very difficult when you're trying to organize on a community basis. It's very difficult to bring people together to talk about theological issues or even to talk about the various teachings of the world's religions. When we really had success bringing people from different faith traditions together is when instead we focused on some problem or concern or issue in the community. We're not coming together to talk about the difference between Buddhism and Christianity, but to talk about making our streets safer or improving the education of our children or, some concrete issue that's of concern. And what we tried to get across and what really has seemed to work is to persuade people that the voice of the religious communities, not just leaders, but congregants as well, the voice of the religious communities can be a very strong economic, social, political voice. So if you're together working on a critical issue, before too long, the barriers start to melt. You do share meals, you share casual conversation, and eventually you're much more open to learning more about what that other tradition actually believes. And a sort of second stage we found in the organization, first you talk about issues, and then you say, let's do a series of kind of round-robin visits to each other's congregations. Mm. And then at that second stage and third stage, the real interaction begins to develop. But we always had much better results starting with critical issues rather than theological or historical education.
That's good. I'm sure that's a question on everyone's mind. I think we could take one more quick question before Jim and Reverend Braybrook wrap up this part of the call. I think David Jones might stand up for a while. David? Okay, well, that one we're not really hearing. So, or Reverend Sue Oliver?
Hi, can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Great.
Hi. Oh, my question was this. As a New Thought minister in the Seattle, Washington area, I've heard we talk about one God, one mind, one spirit, and I've heard the counter-argument to that being that there isn't one God insofar as people worship God in different ways, and to try to bring God under one umbrella and say it's one God is actually not a way to bring us together. It actually can pull us apart. And I was just curious, with the different traditions out there, what would be a way that would embrace the different traditions in a way that would be peaceful and harmonious, in your opinion?
Marcus?
Yes, I suppose for me, and I think it just have to be personal, it's not primarily a matter of argument, but I would say it in the end arises from some mystical experience, and one can't argue people into that experience. But my recent Beacons of Light when I wrote about 100 holy people again and again, it was that sort of experience, a sudden sense, maybe of nature, you're totally at one with that, you have that sense of oneness with all beings. Now, I agree that then how we picture God and how the language we use and so on is very different. But for me, it's at the experiential level rather than the philosophical and theological. That's just a primary motivation.
I agree with that very much, and we have to make the distinction between the reality and all of the world's great philosophical and religious traditions would argue that reality is somehow, at some essential level, it's one. And of course, our apprehensions of that reality and how we understand it, how we verbalize it, visualize it, talk about it, those are going to be many. And that's the rich part. That's the fascinating part. We're not, when we talk about one God, or I'm much more comfortable with one ultimate reality, when we talk about one ultimate reality, we're not ignoring the fact that our ways of addressing that are multiple. And that provides a great deal of richness. So there is one reality. That makes sense. And we're not trying to create one vocabulary for talking about it. Go ahead.
I wonder if I could add just something. A picture I sometimes use, for example, say if your mother dies, and each of you, brothers and sisters, each of you have a particular image, particular memory of her, and somebody else she worked with knew her as a colleague, somebody being a friend. It's the same person, but each of us perceive something special about that person, and that's what I believe that interfaith enriches us. It actually it enriches our spiritual journey because we learn to appreciate even more of the greatness of the one reality.
You know, I think that if Jim and Marcus, if you have any wrap-up or closing remarks, that we should move on to the panel portion of the program, because I know that our panelists are really eager to get involved in the conversation as well. Is there anything else you'd like to say to wrap up?
Marcus, please.
I suppose really say what is so encouraging is the way interfaith is growing right around the world. One keeps hearing of small groups, often places where it's not so easy to be open, and their persistence and their courage. But perhaps above all, the sort of practical actions, really, that we're coming together not just because we want to enjoy each other's company, but because we really want to do something to make a better world. And I think from this, I believe that a new age, a new spiritual age is dawning. And at some stage, this new energy is going to, I'd rather like in Egypt, going to overtake our politicians, and they're going to have to and bankers change their whole way of living.
From your lips to God's ears, as they say.
A sea change.
Well, thank you all very much, and so sorry for all the sound problems, but I think we finally got things more or less on an even keel.